From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at NPR Election Headquarters in Washington, D.C. today. It's Here and Now, and we are live this hour with analysis and results of the election. Donald Trump is promising to unite a divided country after winning the White House last night.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me.
Overnight, global markets plunged on the news, but stabilized this morning. And this morning, Hillary Clinton spoke about that glass ceiling that she failed to shatter.
I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now.
Joining us from Washington is Mara Liasson, NPR's national political correspondent. And Mara, we've had a few hours to digest what, is being called a thunderclap, a lightning bolt, a lot of things being thrown at it, but a shocking to many win given the polls and the predictions. So what are you hearing there? What are you hearing from lawmakers? What are you hearing on the ground in Washington?
Well, Democrats are in a state of shock. They certainly didn't expect this. No one expected this. Donald Trump didn't expect this. Nobody's polls showed this happening. There were a few that showed it very close, but nobody thought that he would win. It was basically a failure of imagination, not unlike what happened during the Republican primaries when the Republican Party thought he couldn't possibly end up being the nominee. I think that in Hillary Clinton's remarks, at one point she said, a peaceful transfer of power is something that we cherish in our democracy. We also cherish the rule of law and the value that we're all equal, and freedom of expression and freedom of worship, and we must defend these values. It seemed like she was making a kind of subtle challenge to Donald Trump, saying if you try to diminish these values, there will be resistance to that. So Democrats have to figure out how they're going to resist Donald Trump. Yeah. They'll do it in the Congress. They're a minority in both houses now. New leaders will emerge in the Democratic Party. I think it's fair to say the Clinton era is over, but there will be new leaders emerging eventually. The question now is, what does Barack Obama do? He was going to stay in Washington until his younger daughter finished high school. Does he become the kind of center of the Democrats' government in exile? It's not going to be Clinton, no. I think. I think when the Democrats do their postmortems, they're going to get in a circular firing squad, as losing parties tend to do, and they're going to point at James Comey, and they might point at WikiLeaks, but they're also going to point at Hillary Clinton, who was a weak candidate and was a status quo candidate in a change election.
Yeah. Mara, what about the change that Trump has been talking about? What about the expectations for what he is going to do when he takes office? We've heard about building a wall, repealing Obamacare, banning Muslims from entering the country, ripping up trade deals.
Is your expectation that he's going to do all those things? Well, no. I mean, some of them are easier said than done, and some of them are easier to get done. Repealing Obamacare, I think, would be relatively easy. The Congress has already passed it something like 60 times. Even most of those votes were symbolic. Now they have to come up with something to put in its place. I think building a wall might not happen. A lot of Trump supporters even said that they thought that was kind of a symbolic proposal. He certainly won't go forward with TPP, but then Hillary Clinton, if she had won, wouldn't either. But in terms of deporting illegal aliens, you heard on your air not long ago Roger Wicker saying, oh, well, Obama deports them too, as if it was just the same thing. The ban on Muslims, that's morphed into a couple different forms since he first announced it. He's also said he's going to appoint a special prosecutor and wants to put Hillary Clinton in jail. Is he going to continue on that?
Well, speaking of that,
there are a lot of things that he will sign that the Republican Congress sends him. The question is, what are things that he wants to do that the Republican Congress will not want to do.
Well, before we let you go, just speaking of that, will we see Rudy Giuliani as an attorney general? Will we see Chris Christie in the cabinet? Will we see the Republicans? And what happens to the Republicans who thought Trump was going to lose and dissed him and now are
working? Well, they're not going to have jobs in the cabinet. although people, it's human nature to accommodate to power. And I think there will be a lot of people, just like you saw during the campaign, when they first unendorsed him, then they re-endorsed him. There'll be people who are coming, to say, gee, I'm sorry, now I'm on board with you. But Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, I don't see why they wouldn't be in a cabinet. He doesn't have a very big circle of advisors. He doesn't have the kind of bench of government in waiting that Hillary Clinton did. So I expect that Rudy Giuliani and Chris Christie will have prominent roles. So will Newt Gingrich. Maybe Bob Corker.
Okay.
That's NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joining us from Washington. Thanks, Mara.
Thank you.
And let's bring in Kerry Haney now, who's an associate professor of political science and co-director of Duke University's Center of the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Gender in the Social Sciences. He's in Durham. Kerry Haney, how much do you think race played into this election?
You know, I think it's an interesting question, and I think it played a significant part of the election. You know, we almost saw a new Southern strategy in the Trump campaign. And by that, I mean Trump ran a campaign that played on or exploited racial fears, racial resentments. And we saw in this campaign not only dog whistle politics, but bullhorn politics, where he shouted some of these things. And that's a break from the past when we would see these things in sort of subtle campaign.
Well, Kerry, give examples, because I can hear Trump supporters, and you know, we'll see it on our social media, saying that's not true. That's not why. So give some examples.
Well, the obvious ones are the references to Mexican immigrants as rapists, Muslims, going to ban all Muslims, that type of politics where you are playing on racial anxieties and some real anxieties to use ethnic groups as scapegoats. I think it's unfortunate.
Talking about that there might be problems at the polls, and you know what I'm talking about, that kind of, you know, signaling that it might be an inner city and therefore, you know, equals a race issue.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, so what happens now? I mean, how do we go forward? We have already seen, we saw some upset in Oakland, California last night, a car set on fire. We saw protests in other parts of California. I think it was Los Angeles, 500 people chanting, "Not my president." In Oregon, anti-Trump demonstrators block traffic, rail lines. What happens now?
Yeah, and I think we'll see more of that, unfortunately, in the coming days. You know, the statement that Secretary Clinton gave earlier this morning was a gracious and what I think is a responsible statement in the sense that she began the type of healing that needs to happen. And I don't think Mr. Trump is yet able to do that. So her statement was very important. It was very gracious and responsible and called on her supporters to accept the outcome of the election and to get behind President-elect Trump. President Obama was very gracious and eloquent in his statement. Also doing some of that same work, trying to pull the country together. And I think Donald Trump is not yet able to fill that role.
I want to go to New Hampshire, where it sounds like we've got some news in a very closely watched Senate race between the Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan and the Republican incumbent Senator Kelly Ayotte. And we're joined by Josh Rogers, who is a senior political reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, at this point, it sounds like Maggie Hassan is declaring victory, but we don't have a call yet from the Associated Press.
No, we don't. Maggie Hassan's declared victory. There are, according to the Associated Press, 100% of the votes are in, and Hassan has a 716-vote margin. That's out of 735,000 ballots. So 716 margin, 735,000 ballots approximately. And Kelly Ayotte says she wants to wait for confirmation from the Secretary of State's office before she does anything. And, you know, one thing she could do is request a recount.
And this would be a big surprise because a lot of the close Senate races have gone to the Republicans over the last 12 hours or so.
That's true. I mean, Democrats did well in the federal races. You know, Hillary Clinton did win New Hampshire. I mean, it's not much consolation for her, obviously. And New Hampshire won its two congressional districts. The Ayotte-Hassan Senate race obviously got a lot of attention, a lot of outside money, more than $100 million. From the start, it was perceived that it was going to be pretty close. And while the polls bounced around a lot, both sides expected a close race, and that's certainly what we got.
Well, it's been said that in other races, Donald Trump did have a coattail effect. It was thought, remember how many months, Jeremy, people were saying that there was going to be a negative down ballot effect from Donald
Trump. People were distancing themselves from him very publicly.
But he did have a coattail effect. But here, remind us, Kelly Ayotte had to fight the perception that she was a Trump supporter.
Well, she her relationship with Trump was always a little awkward. She started out saying she would support Trump but not endorse him. And then, you know, in a debate, she had this sort of miscue where she said that, yes, she would consider him a role model for children. She had to walk that back. And then when the Access Hollywood tape came out, she really tried to kind of cut all ties and said that she would be writing in Mike Pence and would support Trump getting off the ballot. You know, it does seem that Trump benefited Republicans here. And there were Trump-supporting Republicans who said they wouldn't vote for Ayotte. And, you know, Ayotte ran this campaign, and as did the whole Republican ticket, really, you know, as individuals, much less of a team concept than on the Democratic side. But Republicans here did well at the state level. They carried the governor's office and they kept their majorities in the state house. But in the federal races, Hassan, you know, that we'll see if the result holds, but she won. The two Democratic candidates for Congress, Ann McClain Custer, the incumbent, won. Right. That was tighter than expected. And Carol Shea Porter won her fourth go-around with incumbent Frank Ginta. So New Hampshire is going to have four Democrats representing it in Washington, a Republican in the corner office, and, you know, a very, very tight race at the top between Clinton and Trump. So it's a mixed bag here.
In addition to it being a very good night for Donald Trump and for Republicans, last night was also a good one for supporters of legalizing marijuana, both for recreational use and for medical use. Joining us now is Ryan Nurz, chief cannabis correspondent for Fusion and author of the book Marijuana America, One Man's Quest to Understand America's Dysfunctional Love Affair with Weed. Hi, Ryan.
Hello, Jeremy. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. And wow, recreational marijuana legalized in California, Massachusetts, and Nevada. It failed in Arizona and at this moment too close to call in Maine. But it looks like a very good day for supporters of legalizing recreational marijuana.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty much a clean sweep. So for some of the liberals out there that are licking their wounds, maybe this is a little bit of a salve. Yeah, I mean, California, I think, is a big story in the sense that they've tried before in 2010. And now, you know, it's the world's sixth largest economy, I believe. It's definitely going to be the biggest marijuana marketplace in the world. And then the story of basically the West Coast now is a full legal weed wonderland. And I think that other regions like the South and the Northeast are seeing these marijuana states as a success story. And now legal marijuana in Massachusetts and looks like probably Maine. And I think we're probably going to see a trend that just keeps growing.
Well, we were just in Colorado recently and spoke with the governor there. Now, marijuana has been legal in Colorado for a while. And his advice, and by the way, he was against the legalization in Colorado, but his advice was to other states, wait a year or two. There are still some kinks to be worked out in the system. Are these states, California, Massachusetts, and Nevada, ready for what this means?
It's a good question, and I try not to be a lot of pro-marijuana people or people who are sort of into the legalization movement are very gung-ho that it's great, that there's no, you know, health problems, and I don't agree with that. I think that it is addictive, despite some people who say that it's not. There's some respiratory problems that come with it. There is always the concern that it sort of leaks to kids, and when you have a growing brain, it can lower your IQ. There are some problems with it, and I think that all these states need to take a good look at what's happening in Colorado, in Washington, in Oregon, and that data takes a while to really come to fruition. But the problem is that what doesn't take a while to come to fruition is the tax dollars, and all the people that sort of have moral issues with marijuana. Once they see those tax dollars, the look of it gets a bit rosy, and all of a sudden these initiatives get passed.
I think the tax revenues in Colorado are somewhere in the hundreds of millions of dollars. They've made quite a bit of money in tax revenue from marijuana. What about the medical marijuana initiatives that were approved? We're looking at Florida, North Dakota, and Arkansas, and already dozens of states have legalized medical marijuana.
Yeah. So I'm from Florida. I'm a Miami resident, and so it's pretty exciting to see them finally pass something like this. It was you need 60% for a supermajority to change the Constitution in Florida, and so it did not pass in the midterm. It was like 57%, resounding this time. The only thing is, these initiatives, people sort of blanket assume that they all mean the same thing. It doesn't. I mean, Florida is actually very restrictive. It's only for patients with cancer, HIV, PTSD, epilepsy, pretty serious illnesses. But what I do think is interesting is that these are new regions. That is the first southern state to have medical marijuana. Arkansas, another southern state that's getting in the game. And North Dakota, which is in an area that is sort of, you know, adjacent to the West where all that, you know, the legalized marijuana is, but is still a new region. And I think that's really the big story that came out of last night.
How soon is this going to happen in the states that legalized recreational marijuana?
So it really – everything depends on the state. For example, a place like Massachusetts I've been sort of reading up on because that's very interesting to me because I think once you get into this corridor of some of the major Northeast cities like, you know, Boston, New York City, you know, people are going to be eager to see how this works out. And Massachusetts is sort of notorious for having governmental bureaucracy. And so they're already projecting that it could take up to 2 years for them to implement this program. With the recreational states like, you know, Maine and Massachusetts, technically a lot of them, you know, as soon as December, marijuana will be quote unquote legal. It's just a matter of what that means and how long it's going to take for them to actually have dispensaries and have some sort of regulatory board, whether it's similar to alcohol or whatever, actually regulating these dispensaries.
That's Ryan Nurz, chief cannabis correspondent for Fusion, joining us to talk about the numerous marijuana initiatives legalizing recreational and medical marijuana that passed in the election yesterday. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
What does Donald Trump's win mean for the Supreme Court? Emily Bazelon is staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School, and a court watcher. Hello, Emily.
Hello, Robin.
So set the stage for us. We know, of course, Justice Scalia died last winter. That left four justices, four leaning right, four leaning left. Donald Trump was one of the first to call for stonewalling President Obama's choice to fill the seat. Delay, 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 remember he said. What are you thinking today?
Well, now I think there will be a rush to fill this seat when Donald Trump takes the presidency, and that all the talk we've been hearing from Republicans about how it's fine for the Supreme Court to have only eight members is going to go away like magic. And they will probably choose a justice very much in the tradition of Antonin Scalia, because that will be a quick way for Donald Trump to reassure and give back to his socially conservative supporters who really voted for him on the defining issue of the court and on overturning Roe versus Wade.
Trump had a list about 20 judges, a potential nominee list. One of them was a senator, a Utah Republican, Mike Lee. Do you have a guess as to who the first name up might be?
I don't. I mean, none of the people that he talked about are super well known, and that's not a strike against them. They're mostly judges, with the exception of Senator Lee. And any one of them could prove to be Trump's choice. I'm sure they haven't been vetted yet. Who knows how much actual deep background the Trump campaign really has done on them. And so I expect there will be a winnowing and someone will come to the fore.
Well, and what's the relationship going to be? Not that, I mean, there's kind of a firewall between the presidency and the Supreme Court. But remember, Ruth Bader Ginsburg came out publicly against Trump, called him a faker, said she feared for the court and the country if he were to be elected. She walked some of her comments back. That's not new. We had a Supreme Court justice mouth the words "not true," I think it was, at President Obama when he was speaking. But, you know, as a Supreme Court watcher, what do you think about this relationship?
That was Justice Alito who mouthed those words at President Obama. You know, the Supreme Court's relationship with the president depends who's on the court. And Trump will certainly have one appointee, and he may very well have more. We have three quite elderly justices, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kennedy. The more people Trump appoints to the court, the more people are going to have, if not some loyalty to him, because you're right, there's an institutional separation, but certainly a cordial relationship going in. And so I think, you know, the idea that it's true that there are sitting justices who may feel oppositional or defiant toward him, yeah, but his choices will probably not feel that way.
And just real briefly, will we see an attempt to overturn Roe v. Wade soon?
It's a little tricky for that to happen quickly because the court, as you may remember, had a big decision about abortion in the last term, which seemed to settle the question going forward and which Justice Kennedy signed on to. So if there is one new justice, the person filling Scalia's seat, I don't think the court will revisit this question. However, the minute Kennedy or Breyer or Ginsburg is replaced by a Republican president, by a conservative nominee, then yes, I think the court will revisit that question.
Emily Bazelon, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
The U.S. stock market opened steady today on Wall Street after some instability overnight in global markets following Donald Trump's victory in the race for president. And for more on the economic effects of this election, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And as we look at the Dow right now, it is up 161 points, which is interesting because when it became clear that Trump was heading for victory, the Dow futures at one time were down about 700 points. What happened?
Yeah, it was wild, as a matter of fact. And futures actually were what they call limit down. That meant that they were falling by 5%. So they sort of say time out right now. And in addition to that, we saw the Mexican peso cratering by 13%, the U.S. dollar tumbling. And then we saw safe havens like gold and U.S. treasury bonds, as well as the Japanese yen. All those assets jumped. And then a funny thing happened at around 2:30. All of a sudden, we see Donald Trump come out, he speaks, and the selling starts to kind of slow down. And by the time we had the opening this morning, we were flat and now even higher. I think this is a remarkable reversal and certainly maybe instructive, perhaps, in looking back at Brexit, that a lot of people felt like, hey, we got burned with Brexit. We sold initially and then things came roaring back. I think it's a little bit more time and energy being focused on, well, what is going to happen now under a Trump presidency?
Do you expect that over the next several days and weeks that we're going to see a roller coaster ride in the stock market, or do you think they've had their reaction to what happened?
I think we have a roller coaster, and part of it is going to be understanding what the Trump administration's financial priorities are going to be. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the TPP is dead, right? That you cannot go against your electorate, even if some actual Republican Congress people really wanted the TPP. But unless we really have a better understanding of what's going to happen, it's hard to see how markets are going to move in just one direction or the other. I think a few things to keep an eye on is, how does Trump start talking about China? Is he going to continue to use that rhetoric that it's a currency manipulator? Is he actually going to insist on renegotiating NAFTA? And is that possible? Is there going to be some conversation about who is the Treasury Secretary? What is that person's policies going to be? How would they influence the entire economy? All these things are unknown. And during a time of unknown, I think we have a void that is a really ripe for potential volatility, upside and downside.
Economists have been predicting leading up to the election that if Trump were to win, given all the things he said he would do, that we would be headed for recession. Is that being talked about today?
Well, it's not being talked about today, but I do want to remind everyone that, you know, we have been in a recovery period now for 88 months, and that is a very long time. It's not the longest, but we're heading into the top three recovery periods. And I think over the course of the next 4 years, there is going to be a natural slowdown in the economy. Whether that is caused by some exogenous event like a trade war or something going on beyond our control or something that is created because of this new administration, we don't know. But I think that the market's sort of on high alert. But a very strange thing is also occurring. With all the economic distaste that people have expressed around this election, mm-hmm. Here we are actually growing, seeing jobs added, and I think the Fed on track for a December rate hike.
That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
President-elect Trump took the stage at the New York Hilton at around 3 a.m. Eastern this morning.
Working together, we will begin the urgent task of rebuilding our nation and renewing the American dream. I've spent my entire life in business looking at the untapped potential in projects and in people all over the world. That is now what I want to do for our country. tremendous potential. I've gotten to know our country so well. Tremendous potential. It's going to be a beautiful thing. Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Well, Hillary Clinton spoke earlier today. She thanked her supporters, speaking directly to women at times. She also emphasized the need for a peaceful transition.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it. It also enshrines other things: the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them.
President Obama also spoke today, congratulating the president-elect and saying that although Hillary Clinton lost, she set a good example.
I'm proud of her. A lot of Americans look up to her. Her candidacy and nomination was historic and sends a message to our daughters all across the country that they can achieve at the highest levels of politics. And I'm absolutely confident that she and President Clinton will continue to do great work for people here in the United States and all around the world.
Well, it is not entirely over. Donald Trump is leading in Arizona, but the counting goes on in that state. And he had no coattails for one of his backers. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio is out. Here now, Peter O'Dowd has been following that race. We want to turn there now. Peter, what happened?
Well, Joe Arpaio lost, and it lost by a lot. This is fascinating because Arpaio had been in office for something like 24 years. I cannot tell you, familiar with the state, lived there for many years. I can't tell you how important or how central Joe Arpaio was to the identity of this state that has been sort of the ground zero for the immigration debate this country's been having over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Joe Arpaio was so controversial. He was a lightning rod on this issue, and he was just adored by conservatives, but deplored by Latinos. So this guy, Paul Penzone, comes along in 2012. He loses to Joe Arpaio. Penzone is a retired police sergeant, and he is luckier this time around. Here's Paul Penzone speaking to his supporters last night.
We will no longer stand for the things that we've seen, where the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office has been identified because of the notoriety of one. You will now know a sheriff's office who is appreciated because of the sacrifices of many.
So a little bit more of an accepting message there. Arpaio, for his part, accepted the results, and he said he was disappointed, but, you know, the voters have spoken.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Peter, because Arpaio over the years has had very close ties to Donald Trump, who is ahead by about 4 points right now in Arizona.
You would have thought that the fates of these two men would have been really closely tied. When I was there a couple of weeks ago, they were. People saw Trump was trailing in the polls, and now they also saw Arpaio trailing in the polls. But it just turns out that Arpaio's immigration just finally caught up to him. He was involved in a Department of Justice investigation over the last couple of years. Just a couple of weeks, days before the election, he faced federal contempt charges in that racial profiling case that the DOJ was investigating. One person there told me that they've had their own Donald Trump in Joe Arpaio in Arizona for 20-plus years. And so I think finally it caught up to him.
Yeah. Well, NPR's Peter NPR's. And here now is Peter O'Dowd. You know this state so well, as you said. You've reported from there and lived there. How's this reverberating there, do you think?
Well, I can tell you that it's really big on social media, whether you support him or you don't. I think people are not as surprised as you would think. The polls were showing that this was coming. And so it's a very big deal in the Latino community. Organizers had been working for this very, very hard, knocking on doors.
Okay.
It's here now is Peter O'Dowd, and let's bring back in Kerry Haney, who has been with us for the hour, professor of political science and co-director of Duke University's Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Gender in the Social Sciences. Kerry, I want to go back to the presidential race with a question to you about turnout. We're looking at the lowest voter turnout since 2000, and one of the groups that it appears really did not show up for Hillary Clinton in the way that they did for President Obama is African Americans in many of our cities. What happened?
You know, throughout this campaign, there's been a question of whether or not there was enthusiastic black support for Secretary Clinton. And there clearly was a lack of enthusiasm. And we saw that right here in North Carolina. You know, one of the markers I use is my barbershop. Mm-hmm. And I remember 8 years ago and 4 years ago, in August and September, there were Obama signs all over the shop. 3 weeks ago, I went to get a haircut. Not even a Clinton sign to be seen, not only in the shop, but even in the surrounding area.
Why do you think that is?
I think the campaign, in some respects, took the vote for granted. They clearly had some advantages with this demographic, but you nevertheless have to work and ask for the vote. And I don't think that happened to the extent that it could have and should have.
Well, what we're also hearing from contributors like Paris Denard is that many African-Americans expected more. They expected situations to change. And, you know, we know that President Obama had a lot of programs that weren't enacted by Congress. He wanted to retrain workers. I remember some of these programs. But is that a part of it, that they expected more?
You know, I'm not sure that's the case. I think black community is very much aware that President Obama faced the opposition of a Republican Congress that Congress announced that they were going to stand in opposition and make it hard for him to accomplish anything. So I think they're disappointed that there was not much accomplished, but I don't think Secretary Clinton gives blame for that.
What about Latino voters, Kerry Haney? There was all this talk of a surge in a number of states, and then it apparently wasn't really enough to help Hillary Clinton win a number of states. But what do you think happened there? Because a lot of people, after some of the rhetoric from Donald Trump, expected Latinos to turn out in huge numbers for Hillary.
Well, I think they did in many instances. I think in Nevada and Colorado, in this state, in North Carolina, and even in Florida. What happened is that Mr. Trump did extremely well in the areas that he needed to do well. He upped his vote totals in heavily conservative Republican precincts and counties and overcame the increased turnout among Latinos in these states.
Yeah. Well, but to Jeremy's point, we were hearing in the last few weeks, which is, the very end of this campaign, that the Clinton campaign was just realizing that they weren't getting the Hispanic vote that they expected in Florida. And they were getting all these props for, going out and trying to turn out that vote there and across the country. Was that too late?
Yes, too late. And this is my concern about what happened with the black vote, that I don't know why they didn't start much earlier and put the resources in turning out the vote as opposed to running ads, for example. And that certainly is the case. We know quite a bit about Latino voters. You have to recruit that vote, ask for that vote, cultivate that vote if you expect to get it.
Yeah. And just, Kerry, we're going to let you go. But as you look abroad, what's one thing you're thinking about with a President Trump representing America to the world?
You know, I just returned from a trip to South Africa and with a group of students from Duke. And the entire time we were there, over and over again, people kept asking, is this really possible that Mr. Trump can be elected? And what does it mean? What does it mean for the face of the nation? I hope that it's not as bad as it appeared in the campaign, that Mr. Trump will take a step back and look at the U.S.'s position as a world leader and take that seriously.
Yeah.
And just a few seconds, Kerry, but your advice to Democrats who are very upset today about this news, what would you tell them?
I think you have to look carefully at the numbers and the data and figure out, again, how to ask for the vote that you need. Too many votes were left on the table.
Let's get in a voter we met during our election road trip this year. We met Charlotte Bergman at the RNC in Cleveland. She's a Trump delegate, a big Trump supporter from Tennessee. And Charlotte, congratulations. Your guy won.
Oh, I am so excited. Thank you.
You told us at the time, but what appeals to you about Donald Trump?
What appeals to me is this. This is a man of action, and he's going to do more than just talk. Because he is not beholden to anybody else, he's going to be able to represent the people.
Well, Charlotte, you are African-American, and when we spoke to you at the convention in Cleveland, we asked you about the fact that so many white supremacists were supporting Donald Trump, and here's what you had to say.
They probably feel that Mr. Trump may share their values, but that is not a direct reflection on that individual and the individual's own personal values.
Charlotte, since then, have you been disturbed by the increasing number of white supremacists who supported Donald Trump, by the fact that a church in Mississippi was burned and "Vote Trump" was written on it? He seems to have unleashed that in his followers. Does that bother you?
People are free to believe and think any way they want. Mr. Trump is going to be the president of all the people. He cannot control everyone. That is not his job. I know people who know him personally. Mr. Trump is a good man. His inspiration is so great. He got people to go out to vote him in as the next president of the United States.
Well, he certainly did. Well, congratulations again, Charlotte Bergman, Trump delegate from Tennessee.
Let's turn now to the security and foreign policy implications of this election of Donald Trump. And joining us now is Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh, who's with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, during his victory speech this morning, Donald Trump talked about how he sees the U.S. relationship with the rest of the world. Here he is.
At the same time, we will get along with all other nations willing to get along with us. We will be. We'll have great relationships. We expect to have great, great relationships.
Now, he's had some tough talk for some countries and some friendly talk for others, a little different than the Obama administration. But what are you looking at in terms of the security and foreign policy challenges and what's ahead for the new president?
Well, when I think about the foreign and security challenges we face, I sort of put it into four different buckets. The first is active conflicts where there are American troops, places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen. He's going to have to make some tough decisions about the men and women who are fighting in those conflict zones. Then there's a whole second category, sort of potential threats or conflicts or crises. Those are things like terrorism or North Korea. You and I in the past have talked about India and Pakistan. Mercy Corps, humanitarian agency is warning right now that there is a potential famine in Nigeria. So famines or potential mass atrocity events, these are the sorts of things that can creep up on you during an election. And then there are just plain old foreign policy challenges. Russia, China, you know, some of our friends we're having problems with, like the Philippines and Turkey. So there's a full plate here,
Jeremy. Well, let's pick one thing off the plate. How about just ISIS? And, you know, he said during the campaign he knew more than the generals about what to do with ISIS. And he also said you bomb the heck out of them. Of course, we're seeing as troops are trying to get into Mosul that there are civilians there. You can't bomb that city in Iraq now. But what your sense of what a quick study he's going to have to be?
He's going to have to be real fast. It also will depend on the team that he puts together. He's going to have to delegate a lot of this. So his choices for cabinet officials and other sorts of positions is going to matter. And he faces a tough challenge here because many of the establishment national security figures in the Republican Party, the sort of centrist and realist group, together with many of the neoconservatives, signed letters saying that they opposed Donald Trump. Most of them went in the other direction. So he's going to have to put together a team that's competent and immediately deal with these challenges. As for Syria and Iraq or ISIS, I mean, we don't know. He never specified what his plan's going to be. Obviously, we have been bombing ISIS. Yeah. We've been bombing ISIS in Syria for quite some time now. So it remains to be seen. I think we saw two Donald Trumps, one who was sort of more isolationist, less willing to get involved, let people take care of their own problems, and then another one who emphasized strength, strength, strength. I don't know which one is going to win out. Mm.
Jim, do you expect that any adversary is going to try to take advantage of the uncertainty of moving from an Obama presidency to a Trump presidency and do something?
It's a great question, Jeremy, and you're absolutely right to put your finger on uncertainty. If you look at headlines coming out of the world capitals, you see the word anxiety, uncertainty, and that has two impacts. One on our allies. You know, nervous allies can start to fret and start to hedge their bets and think that they have to have a backup plan. That's not a good thing. You know, the South Koreas, Japan's, Europe's of the world. But then you're right. Adversaries may be tempted to act opportunistically or to test the boundaries of a new and unproven president. The number one candidate for that would have been Russia. But they seem to be pals there. We'll just have to see how that works out.
Well, but of course, there's the concern that Russia wanted Donald Trump to be in office and interfered with the U.S. election for whatever end they might have in mind. Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst with the Security Studies Program at MIT, yet another voice helping us, you know, dissect what has happened here at an historic election in the United States. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.